Commonwealth. Mr. White, Ms. Campbell. Good morning. Good morning, Mr. White. How are you, sir?
Well, how are you?
I'm doing. How much time, if any, would you like to reserve for rebuttal?
Say 4 minutes.
Okay. And you may proceed whenever you're ready.
Yes. May I please the court, the court's permission, I will skip the recitation of the facts. The dispositive issue in this case is whether or not title changed to the money that was given by Mr. Mason to Mr. Brown at the time that Mr. Mason went to Mr. Brown's house. This case falls squarely within the analysis of Reed, which was decided by this court almost 3 years ago. The money was given to Mr. Brown for the specific purpose of being a down payment towards a vehicle. And if
can I ask you, yes, you are there, I'm sorry to interrupt, but sure. Your time goes by so fast here. At the time that he gave him the money, they were talking about the vehicle at Louis's, the truck at Louis's, right?
Yes, Your Honor, correct.
And there's no dispute that at that point, Mr. Brown was working at Louis's. Louis's and Mike's, both of those, right?
I agree, Your Honor. I may have misinterpreted it. I thought the Commonwealth argued in its brief that he lied about his employment. I don't believe that's anywhere in the record. In fact, Ms. Bray, who was trial counsel for the Commonwealth, and myself, neither of us really dealt with that issue because I didn't take it at the time that it was ever in dispute.
That he was working at Louis's.
Correct, Your Honor. So at that point, as far as we can tell from the record, everything Mr. Brown had told Mr. Mason was factually correct.
So let me ask you this, because the issue of changing of title.
Yes, Your Honor.
In money generally, when it's changed, when it's exchanged, the actual currency, you get possession and title, at least of those bills. But so here's my question.
Yes,
if he's working at Louis's, and that's where they're talking about the vehicle, and he's paid the $500 then,
yes,
this is before they go to Excel, Auto, and all that,
yes,
how can he be an agent? He's accepting that money for his employer, where he's an employee. So how can, he's an agent, so therefore it's larceny by trick rather than false pretenses.
That's my suggestion, Your Honor. At worst, this is a case of larceny by trick.
I know that's your argument, but I'm having a hard time understanding. If he's employed at Louis's and the vehicle's at Louis's and he pays him for the $500, why isn't he, even though they're not on the lot at Louis's at the time, why isn't that money essentially going to Louis's and therefore title and possession have changed and he's not an agent for him? He's just an employee of Louis's accepting the money.
I believe that has to be answered in two parts. First, if he is, as an employee of Louis's, if there is an actual transfer of ownership of the money, it is to Louis's, not to Mr. Brown. And therefore, if Mr. Brown took the money at that point, then he would be embezzling from Louis's. Or, given that the money had not actually reached the physical possession of Louis's, it would be larceny by trick, because as Mr. Mason made it clear, I believe it's across is on page 26 of the appendix, if I'm not mistaken. I asked him specific questions because I had looked at the case law and I knew that if title didn't transfer, then this would be a case of larceny by trick, not false pretenses. And Mr. Mason made it clear. The money was for a down payment on the car. It was never to be used by Mr. Brown for his own personal use. It's much like the cases, Reed and the cases cited within it, where, I don't recall the name of the case, but one of the examples cited in Reed talked about an attorney being given money just to bribe police officer. Another case where a person was given money for the purpose of buying a suit for the victim, but that person
he was a porter.
Kept the money and bought and produced a bag of rags.
Mr. White, would your answer be different if the appellant in this case actually owned the car?
I believe so. Because then there, he would be acting as his own personal, in his own personal capacity, not as an agent for Louis, or at least perceived to be acting in, as an agent in the transfer of the money from Mr. Mason to Louis.
And your contention is that he was an agent for the victim in this case?
Yes, Your Honor, based on my reading of the cases,
Why isn't he an agent for Louis?
Perhaps a both, but the case law in distinguishing larceny by trick from false pretenses suggests that the point of view of the victim is crucial. Did the victim intend for the money to be used for the purposes of the individual to whom the money was given, or did the person intend for the money to be used for their purposes, and that person, the person being given the money, was just the go-between? For example, the lawyer between the police officer, or the person being given money to invest in the stock market, and yet they convert the money to their own personal use.
So it's the purpose for which the money has been given that you're indicating is the key distinction between the larceny by trick and the larceny by false pretenses. Hence, if it's being given for a deposit, it would fall more under the larceny by trick theory.
Correct, Your Honor. Based on my reading of the cases discussed in Reed, I believe Reed is the controlling authority on that particular issue.
I'm looking at page 26 that you mentioned, and you said in your question, that money, that was never his money, that was always your money, right? And you, and he said yes.
Yes.
And it was intended that he use it for your purposes. Yes. But isn't what, the way I read that was, I'm giving the money to him as a salesman slash employee of Louis so I can get that car. I don't want him to have the money and not Louis. I want Louis to have it, and I'm giving it to him as a salesman employee of Louis so I can then have the car. I'm not expecting to keep the money.
Correct.
I'm giving the money away so I can get the truck. So I guess, I mean, if, I guess I'm having a hard time understanding. Now, if it were Excel where he's not employed,
yes,
I could see where he's an agent trying to get him the truck. But I'm having a hard time understanding if he's giving him the money to buy a truck at Louis at the time the money is exchanged and he is an employee or salesman for Louis, why he's an agent for Mr. Mason, or really even an agent for anybody other than where he's employed.
Well, again, Your Honor, the case law seems to indicate that the analysis focuses on the intent of the individual who is the victim.
Right.
I suggest it would be no different if Mr. Mason actually went to Louis, put the $500 in Mr. Brown's hand, and Mr. Brown never made the deposit. He just put it in his desk drawer. He gave Mr. Mason a receipt, but never really delivered upon that. Yes, he is an employee and an agent of Louis, but from the perspective of Mr. Mason or anyone going into a car dealership, just to use an example, you hand the money over. You're expecting it to go towards the vehicle. You're expecting that individual to use that money for that purpose. You're not, it's an, unlike a loan where I provide someone money expecting them to use it for a particular purpose and pay it back, but they're using it for their needs. And then not only do they not use it for that intended purpose, they don't pay me back. And Reed had talked about that very kind of thing. The repayment of the loan, the expectation, it didn't change the fact that title had changed when the money was given to the individual. So I realize that it can be a fine line. Based on the briefs, I'm going to take it that the Commonwealth and I agree on the law, just how the facts of this case fit within the analysis in the law. Getting short on time, I'll just try to deal with the second issue. And it actually goes back to your question, Judge Beals. The intent to defraud has to exist at the time the money is taken. As you said, there was no question in the record about whether or not Mr. Brown worked at Louis, that he had provided information to Mr. Mason about cars at Louis. In fact, Mr. Mason, in his testimony at some point, I think it was on redirect when Ms. Gray was asking him about it. She also asked him, he answered her questions much the same as mine about the purpose. But he said one of the photographs included Louis on one of the license plates. So at the time the money was handed over and accepted, there's no evidence that any false representations had been made, and I realize that Tomoff said that I didn't really raise that in the assignment of error, but to me, a false representation goes to showing intent to commit false pretenses. The false representations would, in essence, be the false pretense or token cited within the statute.
Well, assuming we decided it's in the assignment of error, don't we have case law that says you can look at the overall circumstances and the fact that he sent him the pictures of the trucks at Louis, more than one, I think.
Yes, sir.
And then he says, I'm interested in this particular truck. And he's like, well, let's get together, we'll go see. And he takes him not to Louis, but to this XL Auto down in Carson, Virginia, that is not even a place where he works, as we have testimony at trial. Why can't that be something that a fact finder could consider as to whether there was intent at the time?
I think it is something that can be considered, but I think there has to be some evidence in the record to support that that was a falsehood, that it didn't work at Louis. I realize, and I'm running short on time here, but I realize that Judge Martin really found my clients incredible, and I'm kind of stuck with that. I would suggest that reading the case in its entirety and the evidence presented suggests that Mr. Brown found himself in a dilemma and started making false representations after the initial transfer. Right? Actually, below my time.
Thank you, Mr. Boyd. Ms. Campbell?
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Lauren Campbell on behalf of the Commonwealth in this matter. The Commonwealth would submit that the trial court did not err in finding the evidence sufficient to convict the defendant of obtaining money by false pretenses.
Ms. Campbell, I'm going to jump right in.
Of course.
It seems like there's a very discrete issue here, which is obviously the classification of whether this is a larceny by trick or larceny by false pretenses. It seems like it turns on the ownership or title, so to speak, of the money, which is not necessarily the easiest concept. What is your position in light of Reed regarding the fact that the victim gave it as a deposit and not intending any portion of it to be given to the appellant?
Certainly, Your Honor. I do agree with opposing counsel that Reed applies, and I think there's language in Reed that says it's very important, yes, what the victim believes is happening, but if whether or not there is a trustee or agent relationship, and I think this court has already touched on, that the defendant was not an agent for the victim. He was more an agent for the car dealership. And I think, as a somewhat common sense, when a person typically walks into a car dealership and works with a salesperson and hands money over, you don't believe that you're still entitled to that money once you hand money over to a salesperson working for a car dealership. A deposit is very similar. The victim in this case was turning over a deposit in order to purchase a vehicle. He was not attempting to retain any ownership interest in that money. He was not attempting to hire the defendant to just go out and purchase him any vehicle. He was giving him money in order to purchase a specific vehicle. And that's how it's different than some of the cases that are cited.
If that's true, then how is it that if he's taking the money lawfully as an agent of Louis, then how is the victim not Louis in terms of an embezzlement? I think that's what appellant is indicating. Because the money then would be taken on behalf of Louis, and he's then secreting it or pocketing it and taking it from, in your scenario, the rightful title holder, which would be Louis.
I think that's an interesting argument, Your Honor. Unfortunately, I don't necessarily think
that's the crux of what he's arguing. It could either be properly larceny by trick or embezzlement. That's one of the arguments I think that he forwarded today.
Certainly, Your Honor. I'm not sure that the argument that this is embezzlement is properly before the court. I think the argument that is before the court is that title did not transfer and the possession and title did not transfer. And I think that based on this record, that's not correct. I think based on this record, possession and title of the money did transfer over when the victim fully believed that he was giving that money over and had no further right to it because he was attempting to put a deposit down on a car. So that's the first argument, obviously, that title and ownership of the money did pass at the time of taking, again, because the defendant didn't intend to create an agent or trustee relationship, as discussed in Reed. Defendant was acting as an agent of the dealership, not the victim, and it was reasonable for the trial court to reject Brown's hypothesis of innocence that he was being truthful about selling this truck. On brief, I did make the argument that Brown's argument that there was no false representation is not encompassed in his assignment of error and therefore is not properly before this court pursuant to Rule 517. However, I do want to touch on it that I think it's reasonable for the trial court to conclude when it was making its credibility determination that Brown straight up lied to the victim about whether or not this car was for sale, whether or not he ever intended to sell it. I think when you look at the totality of the circumstances, that also goes to the criminal intent aspect of larceny by false pretenses, and it was reasonable based on the totality of the circumstances for the trial court to infer that the defendant possessed fraudulent intent at the time that he took the victim's $500. Again, the defendant showed the victim pictures of a very specific red Nissan truck. He then took the victim's money, and he never, as this court has touched upon, took the victim to see that truck, he took him to another car dealership, and proceeded to engage in additional false representations. But the Commonwealth's position is that at the very initial outset, he did have the required criminal intent to defraud the victim at the time he took his $500 and never intended to sell him that red Nissan truck.
Can you go into a little bit about what was argued below? Larceny by trick was argued below, right? So that, but your contention is embezzlement has not been argued below or until now. Is that right?
That is my understanding, Your Honor. I would be happy to look at the record again. But yes, Your Honor, that is my understanding, is that the argument was that this was larceny by trick, not an embezzlement from Louis.
Can I ask you, let's say he's shown him a picture of a truck at XL Auto where they ended up. And we have the testimony from the manager at XL. He's like, I don't even know this man. He's never worked here. If he had shown him a picture of trucks there and they were taught when the money was exchanged, would that be larceny by trick?
No, Your Honor, because the defendant held himself out to the victim as an agent and working at Excel, and the victim testified that he believed that he was there not as someone trying to help him purchase a vehicle, but as someone selling him a vehicle from Excel.
So he wasn't even an agent for him at the point they got to Excel.
Correct,
then.
Your Honor. That's the Commonwealth's position.
If he had told him, well, I don't really work at Excel, but I think I can help you get a car there, and he paid him the $500 and then he took off like he did here and not to be seen again for a long time.
I do think that is a different set of facts, Your Honor. That is more akin to the cases where a victim gives a money for a purpose of continuing representing him, like such as when bribing police officers or investing his money, such as that. But obviously that's not the facts of this case.
Well, how is that any different than a scenario where a person holds themselves out to be something like working in a clothing company saying, I can get you a deal on a suit. You give the money and they abscond. Why wouldn't that be larceny by trick?
You're talking about an employee of a clothing company.
Somebody's saying that it's sort of the same example of working at Excel, where they don't really work there. And they're indicating they work there. We can get you a deal on something. Give me money for a deposit.
But they're holding themselves out as if they work there.
Yeah.
Well, certainly I believe that is obtaining money by false pretenses, because they're making a false representation that they work somewhere and they can give you a good deal if you just give them money for their employer, but that's obviously...
So your understanding of why it turns or is larceny by trick is simply how the appellant or defendant holds themselves out as opposed to why the money has been given.
I think it depends on what the victim believed. If the victim in that case testified and didn't believe that, thought that this person was acting as an agent for them, and they said, I believe one of the cases is a suit case, that the victim gave money to someone to go purchase him a suit, but it was any suit. And the court, I believe the analysis turned on that. Whereas I think in this hypothetical, you're giving money for someone the victim would be giving money to someone they may believe is holding themselves out to as a salesperson for a company, and so I think it really depends on what the victim thinks, and I apologize if I sort of confused that in there, but I think it depends on what the defendant says to the victim and what the victim believes when he or she is turning over possession of that money, whether or not title transfers. I think if the victim believes that they still have some right to that money, then that's again another situation than what we have here. Again, the Commonwealth would submit that the trial court reasonably inferred that the defendant possessed the requisite criminal intent when he took Mason's $500. It's clear from the record that a fraud occurred at that time, that Brown used false pretenses and lies to perpetrate his fraud, and did in fact induce the victim to part with his money. If there are no further questions, the Commonwealth would ask that you affirm. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Ms. Campbell. Mr. White?
Thank you, Your Honor. When a deposit is made for the purchase of a piece of property, car in this case, that deposit remains the property of the person making the deposit until the deal goes through, unless it's somehow designated as non-refundable. So it is, in essence, a bailment. And Your Honor, I was looking for the page number where embezzlement came up in the long colloquy between Ms. Gray and I and Judge Martin. I'm sorry, I couldn't find the right page number. I did mention something about embezzlement, and Ms. Gray said to the court, well, it couldn't be embezzlement because Mr. Mason wasn't his employer. That's sort of beside the point in a way. To quickly address a point about the assignment of error, Rule 5, being technical about it, Rule 5:17 applies in the Supreme Court. I realize there's 5:18 that applies.
5:12 for assignment of error here.
It's our position that possession was not equivalent to a transfer of title at this point, and I agree that the point of view of the victim is crucial in this. What did the victim believe? So that being said, I would also suggest to the court that the evidence of what happened at the time of the transfer did not contain proof of fraudulent intent, and therefore would ask the court to dismiss this or, at worst, remand it for a finding on larceny by trick.
Okay, thank you. We'll come down and greet counsel.